Today is August 16th.
Correct.
And by your clock, it's 24 minutes after 11. And in the morning, it's a Saturday. And I'm in the dining room area of Richard Hesse. And what's your wife's name?
Charlene.
Charlene. Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. She's not with us, but I just thought I'd throw that in. Because sometimes if I might call back, it would be nice to remember your wife's name. And Richard was a member of IVS from 1968 to 1970, and served in the Vientiane area in, excuse me, what most people refer to as the Dondoc School, although it has the proper French name, the École Supérieure de Pédagogie, you know, which, you know, is better, you know, perhaps, but most people just say Dondoc, and they say kilometer 9 sometimes.
Yes.
So we're here to discuss some more of Richard's experiences. And just like everybody else that we've talked to, and I say we because it's Mark Gilbert and myself, it's just not me alone. Mark was the one who came up with the idea for the project. We've started everybody off with a little background kind of question, and I could know this so well, I'm going to put my notes off to the side. Because we, as I said before I started the tape, we didn't have room for all sorts of questions, but we're interested in people's social background. So when, where you were born, who your parents were, how you were brought up as a young man, the things that made you the kind of person that found IVS and thought that this would be a good thing for you to do at mm-hmm. that stage in your life. And from now on, basically, I hope that I will shut up or keep my own contribution to a minimum, except maybe to ask you a question to amplify something mm-hmm. that I think might, you know, need expanding or that I'm vague on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I'll try to make this more your document than my document.
Okay.
So go with it.
Well, please stop me if you want me to amplify anything.
Okay? Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
Just stop me in mid-sentence.
Yeah. Well, I probably won't do that, but I'll make a mental note.
I was born in 1942 in August in Grand Rapids, Michigan. My mother's name was Anne. My father's name was Frank. I had one brother who was older. He is a school teacher, shortly to retire. My parents were Catholic, German. There was a fairly large German Catholic community in Grand Rapids. Many people think of Grand Rapids as being Dutch,
yeah.
Christian Reform, but there was a large Catholic community there, as there were other religions. You have to sort of have a feel for the period of the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And the cultural milieu. Grand Rapids is a conservative city. It's a very progressive city. It's also become quite economically endowed.
Really?
Yes. A lot of the money there is Amway money. Even though it's not very within the city of it. Yes.
Oh.
A very large contributor to the Republican Party.
Oh, too bad. Well.
They have a place there called the Amway Plaza in Grand Rapids. Used to be the Pantland Hotel when I was a child. It's had, Mrs. Bush is going to be there this week, I think.
No kidding.
It's had a number of presidents there, particularly mostly Republicans, and military leaders from that period have all been there. It's quite a place.
Yeah. Go on. I'm sorry.
So I was brought up kind of a conservative atmosphere. Also, a very, very strict Catholic family. I remember, I don't know how much detail you want me to go into, but from a historical standpoint,
yeah.
a period standpoint, the 50s, I can remember not being able to go out and play on Good Friday, having to have to spend the time in the house
Ooh.
Praying the rosary.
No kidding, that is a strict Catholic family. even the strict Catholic families that I knew in the Illinois area would just, like, not eat you know, meat, but that's about it.
About when I was in high school, even though I had dated quite a bit and I had girlfriends and I'd had some experiences with young ladies, that kind of a background, and I can look at it back at it now.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I couldn't see it so much, but certainly as I've gotten older, I've been able to see it, and other people have pointed it out to me. Led me in about my junior year to start to get interested in religion.
Okay.
And Paul doesn't know where we're going on this. So when I finished, by the time I, about my junior, senior year, I stopped dating. I don't know if I dated at all in my senior year. I had girlfriends, but I didn't really seriously date. I didn't do any anything pre-sexual in my senior year. And within 2 weeks after my senior year, during my senior year, I made plans to enter a religious order. And within 2 weeks after I graduated, I left for a religious order.
Oh. Okay. Is this the difference? Because I was looking at 1968 through 70, which is your years of service,
right,
in IVS Laos. Those were my initial years of service in Peace Corps Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
But yet you were born in 42 rather than 45. So
right.
this is the reason for the three-year difference?
This is a big difference.
Okay.
It's part of the difference.
Okay. I was going to ask you what the difference was, and that suddenly dawned on me as you were going through here.
Okay. During my senior year, I had made the contacts, picked out the religious order I wanted to go to, handled the interviews, had the physical, got my clothes together that I was
going to. A physical for the?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
The physical. I guess they can waive that if they want to. You know, mm-hmm. if a person, they might say, well, it's okay, it doesn't pass the physical, but we'll take them anyway. But mm-hmm. they generally prefer that you have, that you're physically fit, that your teeth are in order before you come, that your dental work is all handled. They don't want to take on any. They take on all your expenses at this point. So,
that's true. I knew some people who wanted to go into a religious order, but who had student loans, and they wouldn't take them until
mm-hmm.
those were paid off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They assume responsibility.
Yeah.
Went to Watertown, Wisconsin for 6 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and which was an elementary boys' school run by the Order of Military Academy. And there was only one or two kids there over the summer that couldn't go home. And for whatever reason, I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went to Rolling Prairie, Indiana to a farm, which was called the novitiate, which in the Catholic Church at that time was called a canonical year. I served my canonical year, which
mm-hmm.
was basically some light studying in the morning, physical activity, working. It was a farm, so we did farm work while we cooked, cleaned, took boulders out of the field, clean out the cesspool, feed the cows. All those fun stuff for a year.
Make you humble, get you in touch with nature.
Yeah, they did. Well, there wasn't the physical activity wasn't what made you humble. It was more the discipline and the way you were treated that worked in that direction. It wasn't. Physical work in itself, I don't think, really humbles you.
Oh, really?
Not like people can.
This stuff was more like a boot camp.
It's like a boot camp, yeah.
Yeah,
sort of a religious boot camp. It goes back, I told you that I had written a paper when I was in high school on the Counter-Reformation.
Yeah, this was our talk before we started
right.
the tape, yeah.
Canonical year was something that came out of the Counter-Reformation that was that became a regulation in the 1700s.
Toughen up the ranks so that the heresy won't come back.
Right, or to... Mm-hmm. Just a more discipline. People had to be, the people that came in could not just be from this family or from this group.
Right.
That they had to go through certain things so that they understood what they were doing. So for that year, you had to learn and understand what your vows were going to entail.
That's right.
You had to understand.
Obedience to doctrine.
To doctrine and to people.
Yeah,
It's a line of authority.
When your bishop
like
says something,
yeah.
you salute. You know,
right.
You may not salute, you may... Mm-hmm. You know, put your hands
together and bow.
But, yeah.
So finished in Rolling Prairie my canonical year, went to St. Edward's University.
Where's that?
It's in Austin, Texas.
Oh, really?
Very nice, 100-year-old school.
Never been there.
No, it's everybody thinks of Austin as the University of Texas.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see from the campus, actually, we had a better location because we were older than the University of Texas.
Mm-hmm. One we had the high ground.
Yeah, we had the high ground. We were on the Edwards Plateau. It was a donated property that had been donated by a woman to the order, mm-hmm. so that they could build a college there and a high school.
Yeah.
Still exists. They've done quite well.
I'm sure, yeah.
At that time in the Catholic Church, there were a lot of people going into religious orders. The house I was in was a barracks from World War II.
They were keeping this conical year up.
It was still pretty regimented. We had 120. I lived with 120 brothers, and some what we called professed brothers were people that were already into final vows. We were only temporary vows.
Okay.
Finished my... finished college in 3 years. Mm-hmm. My undergraduate work was finished in 3 years.
And oh, so you did this at the same time?
Not the same time. Yeah, the canonical year was, you did very light classes in canonical year.
Ah.
It was mostly just an adjustment to religious life.
Okay.
That was more to get you into religious life.
But then when you went to Texas, then that tapered off drastically and the academics kicked in.
The academics kicked in. You still had to clean, you still had to cook, you still had to do the yard and this kind of thing. But most of the stuff was academic. You were carried a 15-semester hour load.
Well, some undergraduates who might have a part-time job might have the same sort of experience,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah, not dissimilar to that, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
The probably the advantage or the disadvantage, as some people might see it, is that you're in a controlled environment for college.
Right.
There were no keggers.
There were no sorority babes running through the
women.
Barracks. I don't think so.
We had a librarian. I'll tell this story because it sort of tells the student what can happen. I don't know. Religion is an interesting thing. Religious orders are interesting things, and you start to learn a little bit about human nature.
Mm-hmm.
We had a librarian that was not really good looking, and she started to look good. And so you could.
This is a female.
There were female librarians.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
There were no women students on this campus at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There were only men on the campus. Mm-hmm. You're warned about this kind of thing. You are prepared in the novitiate to deal with homosexuality. They explain
mm-hmm.
it to you.
Mm-hmm.
They say this is what can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Be aware of it. You're going to be denied this kind of thing. You're not going to see much of it. You may see some of it, but you won't see much of it. And you will look for options. And
mm-hmm.
be aware that you look for it. Take responsibility that you may look for options. Be aware of it. And you have to protect yourself against that. So you are prepared for that like you are for anything else. So we were really cut off. We got one beer. I think my second or third year, I got one beer on Christmas or some holiday, I think. But no alcohol.
No, of course not.
Tobacco was limited to certain periods in the afternoon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
wow.
After meals. You couldn't freely have tobacco. TV was quite limited to the news. On occasion, we could watch an opera on television.
Uh-huh.
I think when I was in the novitiate, I think I saw television twice in a year.
Uh-huh.
So it was a rather regimented, which made school a lot easier. Getting through college in 3 years was not that difficult in that kind of an environment.
Yeah.
You were up at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning.
You had nothing to do but work.
Nothing to do but work, and you were in bed at 10 o'clock.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So I wish,
I'm going to pause here for a second to talk about my students. I'm going to put this back on again.
Okay.
We can only understand when we've got some of our own experience to bounce off of our acquired knowledge from our parents to come up with our own new synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, the damn kids don't understand.
But anyway,
you were subversive. You got me way off on that,
okay.
on that tangent,
which was something that you sensed and rightly so.
Well, I was thinking about my students and how they would love to hear what you were saying about the discipline and things like that. But okay, so you were there, and they put you through this.
Mm-hmm.
They got you through.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were off tape, you mentioned that you're not really sure if you would have had the self-discipline, but by God, you had that fear of the church authorities.
Yeah, and the fear that I had been brought up all through school, that do what you're told, and not fail.
Uh-huh.
And the expectation was that I would go to class, that I would do my duties around the house.
Uh-huh.
I did my duties. I went to class.
Yeah.
I finished. So.
Gold star.
Yeah, gold star. My third summer. Well, I had taken a vow, what they called the fourth vow. A lot of people never heard of the fourth vow.
I don't know. What are the first three?
The first three are poverty, chastity, and obedience.
Oh, okay. All right.
For the most part, the people, I don't know if you want to want all this on tape, but there's a very quickly the difference between most of being a priest and being a religious. You can be a priest and a religious.
Uh-huh.
But if you are a priest, don't necessarily take the vows. They take only obedience to their bishop.
Uh-huh.
A religious takes poverty, chastity, and obedience. They have to be poor. A priest can have money.
Yeah.
But they have to be obedient, and they have to be chaste. I guess they have to take a vow of chastity, or at least that's the agreement, that they have to be chaste.
But you had a fourth.
A fourth. Foreign mission vow.
Oh.
I had to do it all. And I asked to go to, a lot of the young men that I was with had come out of high schools run by the Brothers of Holy Cross. I did not. I was trained by nuns. I went to school with nuns from grade school through high school.
Did you call them penguins?
Yes.
Yeah, you did. I always wondered.
Among other things, you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm sure the other things, but I've always wondered about them.
And you only, I can assure you that you only appreciate them after about 20 years. It takes 20 years to really appreciate them. The young men that I was with, many of them had gone to brother schools,
uh-huh.
and there had been geared up to the ideal of going back to a brother school and teaching in a brother school.
With their vows. But you had something else.
And I had not had the experience of going to school with brothers, so I wasn't really in gear to go to a brother's school.
No, you just knew the nuns, and you didn't want any part of that.
It helps if you understand that about five of the brother schools were on the West Coast. And so it was,
nice.
Very enticing to go to a brother's school on the West Coast.
Yeah, go to Malibu High.
Malibu High. I'm trying to think of the
anywhere in the West Coast would be fun.
Long Beach was one of them.
Oh,
school in Long Beach.
Tough.
Yeah. At any rate, I had taken the foreign mission vow,
mm-hmm.
and no one else had taken it. I don't think anybody else had taken the vow in my class.
Mm-hmm.
So I had not really realized this. Of course, I was very naive that I was the only one taking the vow. So I was the obvious choice for that year to go to the missions.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So. But I couldn't. Where they wanted to send me was what was called East Pakistan at the time, which is now
Bangladesh.
To go to Bangladesh, you had to have another year of college. So before I graduated,
you mean a fifth year?
A fifth year of college.
Ooh.
You had to start graduate school.
Uh-huh.
Okay. In fact, you had to finish graduate school. Usually, they did it in a year. Before I finished. I started they wanted me to be in Washington, D.C. at Catholic U for the summer to start a special class that they had running at the seminary in preparation, because they did the same thing with the seminarians. They also ran them through the same class, so they wanted me there for that. So I had to leave college, and I had 3 hours to go on my bachelor's, and they did the 3 hours from the studies that I would do over the summer, and the following year they graduated.
Okay.
So I finished college in 1966
mm-hmm.
with a bachelor's in education with a concentration in social science. Started that summer of 66
mm-hmm.
At Catholic University of America in a program called the School of Education in comparative education. They had another name for it too, but Comparative International Education in a concentration in Asian Studies.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
So
they were really pinpointing where you were going to go.
They were going around. Yeah, they were very clear.
Yeah.
I lived in a seminary, a special seminary, which was called the Foreign Mission Seminary.
Did this particular order, I don't know,
they run Notre Dame.
Yeah, but in terms of some of the missionary stuff, I know that some orders specialize
yes.
in countries
no.
or continents. Did they specialize in Asia?
No, they didn't specialize in Asia.
Oh, okay.
I think they had missionaries in South America. I know the brothers did. They ran a school in South America, Africa, All the brothers did not go to Africa, I don't think. Not the teaching brothers, I don't think. They may have had run a school in Africa, I'm not real sure. But I was to go to, the big one that they were really working on at the time was East Pakistan.
Uh-huh.
And I was to go, they had two or three schools in East Pakistan, and I was to go to one of the schools.
Okay.
I lived in a house in a special seminary, for what they called the Foreign Mission Seminary, separate from, they had another seminary where the Holy Cross priests went, the seminarians went, down the street. And that was for regular seminaries. But if you're going to the foreign missions, they put you in this other one. And the, most of the people there, the priests had, the seminarians had to stay, I think, for 3 or 4 years. I only had to stay 1 year.
Okay.
Because I was in regular college. I wasn't in the seminary system.
Right.
I was there for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the house was made up of missionaries to some degree that were on leave. And so I lived with people that had lived in Africa and in Pakistan.
So you socialized in this.
I socialized in that environment
for
a year. And then the weekends, these priests would go out to churches where priests were on vacation, and they would give a sermon, and they would have a special collection for the mission. So they were also raising money. They were on their sabbatical raising money for the missions. Finished? I didn't finish. About the, and this is where we get into the, a lot of things. My brother, my older brother, was also in the seminary at this time. He was becoming a Dominican priest. And he wrote me a letter. It was a time when I wrote letters. I don't do that anymore.
I do email now.
it was pre-email. And he wrote me a letter and said he was leaving the seminary.
Uh-huh.
And it made me question whether I wanted to stay in. And
really?
As we talked earlier, and I said that I don't know if I would have done this if it had not been for Holy Cross in being to some degree the upbringing that I had and the discipline and the fear of failure and the fear of doing what was right and doing the right thing, all this, whether I could do that on my own. And I became very aware of that. I was also in a much looser environment. I wouldn't say looser exactly, but I was in an environment where I had a lot more time to think than I'd had in Texas.
Uh-huh.
I was very busy in Texas. In graduate school, I was not that busy.
Uh-huh.
I might have one class a day, if I had one class a day. And so I started to say, I've got to do some things on my own. I've got to find out who I am. Because what I was at that time was a religious brother of Holy Cross. I was Brother Richard.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know who I was as a person. So I left. And they were very good. I mean, I cannot fault Holy Cross. I mean, they were first class. They were not up happy about it, but they really were helpful. And
they probably had seen it before. They probably knew that it was better that this happened now rather than they getting you all the way to then East Pakistan and have you go through
problems.
Yeah, and then quit. Yeah.
So they said, you know, the guy was real. The guy that was in charge of me, my religious superior, sent me home for a week.
Uh-huh.
To go home for a week, and then my next assignment was to go to a boys' camp in Ohio to work for a year, for a summer.
Uh-huh.
Then my vows ran out in August. So, God, I'm just realizing my vows just ran out today. Holy shit.
Your what?
My vows. August 16th was the day my vows ran out. Years ago. It would be 19...
This is an anniversary.
This is an anniversary. It was actually about the 15th. I think they were on the 15th or the 16th. I think I took them on the 15th, so I guess they would run to the following 15th. Anyway, it would have been August of August 15th of 1967.
So it's a day. It's a day.
It's a day.
Yeah. Okay.
You
did, and obviously you didn't celebrate yesterday, or commemorate.
I don't even think about it.
Yeah.
I don't even think about it. And but it's strange that we would be having this interview and it would come out at this time. And I finished the boys' camp. We finished my work at the boys' camp. And my parents, I think my parents picked me up. I think they drove down to Ohio and picked me up. And I went home, looked for a job,
uh-huh.
found a teaching job in northern Michigan,
uh-huh.
Taught a year in northern Michigan in a high school in Posen, Michigan. And then during that year at Posen, I started working on getting into IBS. When I was in Washington, D.C. in graduate school, I'd seen posters. I wanted to go in Peace Corps, and I'd made some telephone calls, but I knew I was leaving the religious order. You do this. It's strange. When you're leaving a religious order, you do start making preparations. And I couldn't work it out the first year, because it took a little time, but I looked into Peace Corps, and I looked into Asia. I got interested in Asia. I got interested in Indochina. And
How come?
I don't really know why. I had people in class with me that were going to Vietnam. The government, as you remember, the period, and I don't think the young people probably, you know, and you can't really explain it, the number of Americans, as I said earlier, that were running around in Asia in the 60s and 70s. The government was desperate for people because they were pouring people into Indochina, and not just military.
Right.
There were a lot of support personnel there, and there were a lot of, and in my classes, I had nurses. We had a good, Catholic U has a good nursing school, and I had nurses in there, and some of them were getting a graduate school paid for by the U.S. government in exchange for a tour as a nurse outside the military in Vietnam. And there were going to be support personnel. Of course, there were a number of, we had Filipinos there. We had a number of people that were in preparation. We were in Washington, D.C. We were in the state, in the federal capital. So it was natural for a number of people to be showing up in class that were going to Indochina.
And so, you said posters, too, for IBS?
I saw a poster. I think it was for IBS.
Oh,
it could have been for Peace Corps. But at any rate, when I called, I know I called Peace Corps. I know they said, we don't go there, but look into IBS, because IBS goes
so
there.
So you were referred.
Oh, referred. And you know why IBS did not, why IBS went and Peace Corps didn't.
Oh, yeah. You don't want government-sponsored, non-military young people coming home in body bags.
Yeah. Right. Plus, it could have stained Peace Corps someplace else.
Yes, yeah, because they would have been linked up with some sort of pacification kind of program, which is tainted.
Which is what we were to some degree.
You mean IVS.
IVS, yeah. To some degree, and you are aware of that. We weren't pacification so much, but we were winning hearts and minds.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think of it in a broader sense. Yeah.
And many of us, I wasn't aware of it when I went. So I did the, after I finished my year in high school, I did the preparation, got the shots, got the physical, got all
another physical.
Another physical, got all lined up, and finished my year of teaching, and was off to IBS.
Were you interviewed by them?
Yes, I was interviewed, I think, in Ann Arbor.
In Ann Arbor?
I think it was Ann Arbor. I know I came, I knew I had to drive south one day. Took a day off from school, and I drove south. It was, I think it was Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. I think I drove all the way to Ann Arbor and back up again.
When you were in Washington, you didn't talk to them?
No, never talked to them. I didn't hadn't cut the, it took a while.
Okay.
This was a correspondence over the year I was a teacher in Northern Michigan.
Oh, okay. I didn't make that connection because I thought that you were questioning your vows when you were in Washington and already exploring options, and the IBS office was in Washington.
Yeah.
It would have been the logical thing
to
just catch the bus at that time.
It wasn't
go downtown and, you know.
Yeah, but you'd have to know me and you'd have to know religious life.
Well, I couldn't, I also have to get the sequence.
Yeah, I didn't have that kind of freedom.
Okay.
I didn't have that kind of freedom. I didn't, I mean, like I could get on the bus on occasion if I had permission. I could give money if I had permission. To start the interview process, to have contact with these people until my vows ran out, would have been inappropriate, and I couldn't.
Okay.
I just couldn't have done it.
So they were going to be helpful, but they had limits.
There were limits, and they didn't. I didn't really know what I was going to do at the time. I mean, I was exploring a number of options, and that was the primary option. What I wanted to do in the year in high school teaching in Northern Michigan gave me the time to work it out, and this seemed a logical thing. And just as it took me almost a year longer, actually, but to work myself into religious life, I had to check things out.
Well, no, this is a really significant life change.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't do these, you know, like that. I mean, even if the final step is done quickly, there are steps preceding it. So I understand that. What comes to my mind in terms of a question as I hear you talking links up your decision to take that fourth vow of the foreign mission, and then when you're exploring alternatives, you're still thinking in foreign terms. Now, you said that you chose the fourth vow, not really realizing that most people didn't. But was there also something in you that made you want to go overseas?
I don't know.
Okay.
I really don't know. I had an interest in Europe. I know that.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I had really that much interest in Asia. When I was in graduate school, though, I was studying in Asia. I was going
That's to, different. That's,
yeah.
you know, that's after the vow.
Yeah.
I was wondering about
no.
to make the vow.
I don't think so.
Okay,
there
was just happenstance.
Like that. No, it was happenstance. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Because yeah. some people it might be.
Yeah.
You know, if in their church they might have seen foreign missionaries coming in, they might have, you know, imbibed something. If they had read Tom Dooley's books, they may have imbibed something.
I did read Tom Dooley.
But that doesn't necessarily yeah. translate to making
right,
the choice.
Right. I
it could,
Tom
but
Dooley
it doesn't.
In high school, the order, when I was, the parish I was in Grand Rapids, had missionaries in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
I had seen and heard missionaries in Thailand talk, but I never really had any great desire to go to Thailand.
Okay, so these influences were there, but they didn't really impact
no,
you as
I
much as
so.
The happenstance.
No.
Okay. No, I mean, that's fine. I mean, you know, because some people have very clearly said that they would meet missionaries coming back from overseas and they
mm-hmm.
wondered about it and their interest was piqued. Their,
mm-hmm.
their interests were piqued. I don't know. Anyway. And other people have mentioned Tom Dooley as being a real impact on them,
mm-hmm.
whether they went to Laos
oh,
or Vietnam.
It's a great Tom Dooley.
It was
a very impactful book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they made a big impression at the time. But that doesn't mean that those influences, even if they were present for you, would have the same impact on you as
mm-hmm.
a person.
I don't think I really thought about Tom Dooley except for us talking about it. I
yeah.
remember being impacted by the books, but I don't
yeah.
remember having been necessarily wanting to go.
Yeah, it didn't stimulate you to
no.
take a specific action.
No.
Just broadening your general frame
no.
of reference for the world.
No.
Okay,
foreign
fine.
Missions was just a part of religious life.
And you accepted
it. Accepted it.
You checked it off.
Yeah, I checked it off. That's what I'm
no, that's fine. You know, I just wanted to clarify.
Why Indochina? I don't can't tell you that either.
'66, '67, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we already had our, we had troops long before.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I mean, as far as the Marines actually landing, you know, not the advisors, but regular troops,
mm-hmm.
that's March of '65. So our boys, in with quotes around our boys, are already involved. So the American public is more focused. I forget when the Tonkin Gulf incident.
I remember that I was on vacation. I was with my parents in a hotel in Ohio at the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be, let me see, I came home in 67. It would be about 65.
Mm-hmm.
About 1964, 65, that summer.
Well, yeah. Well, but in any case, these things are happening. So it's part, you know, if why Indochina? Maybe it's just part of the.
Yeah, could be.
The Bellevue.
It was certainly something that. People wanted to do something about
mm-hmm.
something we cared about.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know. You know, it's
yeah.
One of the things I'll mention, possibly from a research aspect, is that in D.C. I saw funerals, young black people, because as you know, D.C. is primarily black.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of black were going to the
mm-hmm.
war, and this was brought up by my students because
mm-hmm.
the. Propaganda. We got China on the radio. We got North Vietnam on the radio. So they would ask me about this too, and it was true that, I mean, we saw, it was also a period that they were, because a number of black people were being buried in Arlington, they had that option, and it
mm-hmm.
was convenient to the families. They would want them buried in Arlington, and there was at this time the government was wanting to start putting limits on who could get buried in Arlington, and
mm.
it was a rather nasty incident.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I remember the funerals
mm-hmm.
when I was downtown in D.C.
Hmm.
That's weird. We knew better.
Did we? I don't know. So when you did contact IVS, did they? You said they interviewed you in Ann Arbor. You took
mm-hmm.
some time off. Did they? What was the interview like?
Don't remember.
Okay.
Very, very little, nice kid, nice young man.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for, I guess, I don't know who he was. I should remember his name. I don't.
It's okay.
It was just an evening. I'd driven all day from northern Michigan, from Alpena, near Alpena.
Oh, well, that's quite up
there. And then I drove back that night in my Volkswagen. My 61 Volkswagen. That's another cultural thing that young people would never understand.
So was a country mentioned at all when you were...
I don't know. I think we talked about education team because I had a... I was very close to my master's in education.
Okay.
And so the education team seemed to be the best option. It was what I was interested in. I had no agrarian experience.
Yeah,
so
right.
Rural, I would have been, you know, other than feeding cows and picking up rocks out of the field when I was a novice. I had no concept of growing anything. I was a city boy.
Okay, so, well, I was just trying to think if you had selected a country or if they had selected one for you, or maybe what I'm hearing is that because you said education, they might have had some education openings and therefore slip them in.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, okay. I was just trying to figure out.
I sort of did. Well, originally, I wasn't supposed to go to Vientiane.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was originally supposed to go to Sam Tong in the mountains.
Aha, yeah, okay.
Which would have been a whole different experience.
Yeah.
Had I gone to Sam Tong versus Sam Tong versus, you don't understand Sam Tong.
Yeah, I'm putting it in my mental map.
Yeah.
And getting up there.
They were usually kept only one education person up there. Uh-huh. This was a stronghold for the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
Very not talked about a great deal.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Ultimately, I don't think they put any IBSers up there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that even by 68, 70, they were thinking about that.
Yeah.
Maybe they were in the process of closing it down, and that's why you didn't go.
It's possible. I don't think they were really, the Vietnamization didn't start until about my second year in Laos. I just don't think they really wanted to put anybody up there that they didn't have real, real good control over and didn't know real well.
Mm.
I met the guy that was up there before me, that was what was there before me, and they didn't put anybody else up there that year. A nice young man. And he had been up there, but it was...
Do you remember who he was?
A young black man. I can't tell you his name right offhand. He had real problems with malaria. He had some terrible malaria.
Was he American?
Yes.
Okay. Because I met a black Haitian who was in IVS Laos. Mm. Oops, I just forgot his name.
That's okay.
But there was another black fellow who has the unfortunate name of White.
Could be White.
Paul White.
Could be Paul White.
Yeah.
I know the name.
Yeah. I haven't interviewed him. We have not established contact with him. But I think he's now overseas with something.
Well, see, now he was already being picked up by AID.
Yeah.
He was at
I think he's still been in that track. Whether he's with AID any longer is another thing altogether. He may be into something else.
They hired him, I think, after he finished his tour.
Yeah, yeah.
But Pop Beale was up there then. I don't know if they ever talk about Pop Beale.
Some have, yeah. But you wouldn't have had a chance to know him.
Well, I would have been. He would have been up there when I was.
No, but I mean, way it worked out, didn't.
No, I never met the man.
Yeah.
So that's the.
Yeah.
Where we go from there.
Okay. Well, no, it's just I'm trying to work my way kind of chronologically and by theme. You know, theme of your life, theme of finding IVS and making a fit into IVS, and they deciding where to send you and. Your reaction to it and all. What kind of training did they give you?
I flew out of Grand Rapids within days of finishing school. Again, I just went right off again. I went home for a couple days and got on a plane. I think they sent me a plane ticket.
Yeah.
Got on a plane. And Walt Haney was on the same plane. He got on East Lansing.
Okay.
His parent, I guess his father was a professor here.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
And he got on the plane, and he was a young man, and we were two young men on this plane.
Mm-hmm.
Got off, and I asked him, I said, are you going to IVS? And he says, yeah. Like, we shared a cab. We went to some hotel, I think it was in DuPont Circle, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we took a bus downtown or a taxi, we caught a train up to Harper's Ferry, and we had an orientation at Harper's Ferry.
Mm-hmm.
And they were still doing that when I went back to Catholic U to finish my master's, which would be 2 years, 3 years later,
mm-hmm.
They were still using, I went up to Harper's Ferry for an orientation to talk to the orientees.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And
that would have been by 73?
God.
Because you got out in 70.
70. The next year I just was teaching part-time.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be about 72, I'd say.
72 you went off to Harper's Ferry.
Wait a minute, I was before I was married, though. Yeah, it was about 71, 72.
Okay.
Trying to think what I did. Yeah, about 71, 72. I'd say about summer of 70, I don't know, 71, 72.
Okay. You probably would have only been talking to people who were bound for Laos at that time.
I think so.
Because by that time, the Vietnam program was being closed down.
Mm. Okay.
That's what I was just trying to
say. Think I know people were going along because I was asking questions. I talked to a girl. One of the girls just wanted to ask me some questions because they want to ask me in front of the group.
Yeah.
Or what it would be like to be a girl over there and stuff. So we had
let's pursue this.
Yes.
This right now. We'll come back to the chronological thing because I don't want to lose this. How did it feel to be like the senior talking to the freshman? You know, what did you tell them about Laos, and what kind of questions did they have, and especially this woman?
Well, the talk basically, I just was there for the evening, and I was stayed overnight, I think. And I talked about what it was like being a volunteer there and
mm-hmm.
experience. We had an AID person there, of course, was still a young person in AID. And they were still pretty much in where they were doing their job about
mm-hmm.
what it was like to be in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the one exchange, we didn't have a really nasty exchange because I wasn't really into that. But, you know, I basically said, you know, you can't use the same kind of morals that, you know, if your enemy is, if somebody that you oppose is using certain tactics, you don't use the same tactics. You don't equate, we should not be equating ourselves with other people. We should have a standard separate from that.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And just because certain inappropriate things are done by one group of people does not mean that we should take on those same kind of tactics, that we should be above that. I remember that.
And the AID guy didn't agree with that?
Well, I think he had to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like being against motherhood.
Yeah. I can't say, see, IBS, like religious life, you can't, you know, some people get the negative. I've been to religious reunions with people that I was in religious life with, and
mm-hmm.
they have some very bad experiences. Now,
mm-hmm.
I didn't have any bad experiences. I mean, I was tough, and there were things that probably should not have happened while I was in there, and there were probably people that treated me badly and this kind of thing, but I don't really, you have to take it as a total picture, and you have to take
mm-hmm.
IBS as a total picture.
Yeah.
And I certainly have things that have affected me and probably affected me negatively about the experience. But I also have to say that, you know, there's a positive side to it. There are things that you grow from this. And so you take it as a whole. You don't emphasize the positive totally or the negative totally.
And this is what you told the incoming...
Yeah, I think I might have mentioned that. But I don't... I think that the temptation in a situation like this is to emphasize the negative.
Uh-huh.
There's a terrible thing because you know that all these people are walking in there with a great deal of idealism
mm-hmm.
and with a great deal of good feelings about what they're going to be doing.
Yeah.
And I know what happened to me in those 2 years, particularly in the first year,
mm-hmm.
when I started to realize that what I had expected was not reality. That this was not, that I was doing something worth doing. Teaching is a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
We agree on that. Teaching is a good thing, working in a school, working with people that, and you're giving them certain opportunities. But I think the realization for me, particularly by the end of the first year, was that I was investing my students in an American presence
mm-hmm.
in a place that there was not going to be an American presence, that we would ultimately have to leave with the tail between our legs, and that these people had invested in the English education, and that they may pay for that with their very lives. That was not a pleasant thing to think about. So
you might have told that to the volunteers, too?
I think I might have. I don't
okay.
know.
let me pause for just a second to tell you why I'm kind of pursuing that. Well, first of all, I can say, well, the tape's on. Of all of the people that I've spoken to, whether from Vietnam or Laos, I had a number of them tell me that when they were at Harper's Ferry, usually, although a couple other places, that they sometimes had former volunteers come in, you know, to tell them what the experience was like, exactly what you did. And that they tried to present a balanced picture and tried to take away some of their naivete.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that had an effect on people.
Mm-hmm.
That was perhaps good. But that they heard a lot of negative things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still
saying
for the tape's sake what I've heard from other people. But you're the first person I've spoken to who was the former volunteer telling the new ones.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I was just interested in how you saw your role.
And
the only thing I would say off tape, and I think I'm going to let the tape keep on going, is that I remember in Peace Corps Philippines a couple people who would come in when I was in training to tell us what the real picture was like, who were very negative. Yeah, and I had a negative response to them because I said, "You're just a malcontent," you know, and I don't want to be bothered by your bullshit. You know, if you got to hang up, deal with it.
This is I'll give you a parallel for this.
Okay.
I'm in an office, and I have in my office in the next cubicle is a wonderful young man who is what's called a governor's intern.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, these are all very bright young men.
Mm-hmm.
Well educated, connected, and many of them are. I don't know if they all are, but the ones I run into are connected. And it's a nice way to move people into state government that the government likes.
Uh-huh.
Okay, most
uh-huh.
of these people, if not all that I've seen so far, are male or female and white.
Uh-huh.
And this is for our state.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
For our state, this is not. I mean, we in state government in Michigan. Affirmative action almost doesn't exist anymore.
Really?
No one's going to say that, and they will tell you, yes, we have a Civil Rights Bureau, and we have an affirmative action program, and we have an affirmative action officer, but it is nothing what it was. And
probably the hires are not on the tracks where these kids are headed.
Right.
Yeah.
If they're hired at all.
Yeah, it'll be a clerk.
Right.
Well,
we had situations where we would bring in people of different colors and races, and we would put them in special programs and give them opportunities.
Yeah.
Whether that was appropriate or not, I don't know if that was appropriate or not.
Uh-huh.
But I think it was something that should be done, because I think that as a country, we have to do this. We
mm-hmm.
have to try to work on inequalities, regardless that there may be some price for that,
mm-hmm.
and there may be some inappropriateness to it in some cases. And I can understand people might find that inappropriate, but I think it's something we have to do,
mm-hmm.
regardless.
No argument here. no counter argument. Yeah.
And I think we're going to pay a bigger price later if we don't.
Yeah.
But we already have. But at any rate, this young man, and we are good friends. I think we have a lot of fun together. He's funny. He's very sharp. But I have to be very careful because he's not prepared to hear the realities of what I see as realities of a person that's been in government for 19 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing in an orientation with people in Peace Corps or IVS. People are coming in, they're young, they're idealistic, they want to hear a positive message because that's what they're there for.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult, and I don't even know if you can, really, and I don't know whether you should. I think you have to try to give them a taste of what reality is, but I think you have to be kind of gentle about it, and I think you have to be realistic, and you have to understand where they're coming from.
Yeah. Yeah, and unfortunately, the way that this guy presented himself, he didn't understand that I and perhaps other people, I can't speak for the other people in my training
mm-hmm.
group, this is the agriculture sector, there was about a dozen of us. I don't know about how the other 11, 12, 15 other people reacted to him, but I was negative.
Mm-hmm.
But I did recognize that he was very sincere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and later, as a matter of fact, he was assassinated in Nicaragua.
Wow.
When he was there as part of a University of Wisconsin team on land reform.
Yeah.
So he was very dedicated, very
yeah.
sincere person, but he didn't know how to approach someone who's coming right off a college
mm-hmm.
campus and wants to help save the world.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I just didn't want to see him.
You know. This is you know, what you've described is a central issue that that I've dealt with several times in my life, and it's fascinating. I'll tell you the story. If you want to hear my tape, it's fine. I don't really care. I'll tell you the two stories. Well, there's a story I told you in the paper about the fella saying you're going to take away more than you give.
Yes.
And yeah. I'd always
this is from your IBS experience. You're going to profit. You're going to give back to the people you're supposed to help, but you're going to be helped much more than they. And
that was like a light going off, because that was not. It was totally reasonable,
mm-hmm.
but it was putting what I was doing in a whole different light, because I had been brought up. You're making these sacrifices constantly.
Yeah.
You're not getting nothing.
And
a lot of times.
And you were making sacrifices.
You were making sacrifices.
You are. Yeah.
I mean, I was, you know, chastity was in poverty and obedience wasn't easy, but I got something back.
Yeah, and even in IBS or Peace Corps,
you
do sacrifice a couple years of your life when you could be on some track going towards higher retirement pay or whatever bullshit. You know? So you do give that up, but that ain't nothing. compared to what you get back.
Experience.
It's the cheapest experience you'll ever get.
And there's that side, but no one had really ever put that in words for me.
Uh-huh.
Because constantly people were talking about making the sacrifice, bury yourself, mortify and fortify, you know, this kind of thing. And this guy says, hey, you're going to take more away than you're going to give. It was like a light went off. And I saw so much of what I had seen before put in another light.
Mm-hmm.
It was wonderful. And you would see this. I've seen a couple, you know, when I was in religious life, when I was at Notre Dame for a short time, for one summer, and I had a religious superior, and we were talking. I just started the novitiate then. And we were talking about various things we wanted to do and stuff, and this guy would, you know, he would say, and people would complain, oh, no, this was in Washington.
Okay.
We're in Washington, D.C., and some people wanted to go to a football game. They wanted to see some of these people had been at Notre Dame in the seminary.
They wanted to see Notre Dame.
They wanted to see Notre Dame play in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
And the guy said, I don't want to send you. I don't want to get you tickets to go to Philadelphia. He said, if you had come to me and you would say, I want to take some, because we did tutoring. One of our responsibilities was to do some tutoring in the inner city when I was in D.C. And he said, if you wanted to take some kids from your tutor that you were tutoring and take them to the football game.
And you're the chaperone.
And you're a chaperone. I would have said, yeah, I'll buy the tickets.
Uh-huh.
But since you said, I want to go, I'm not going to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, people, you know, as a Christian, this wasn't Notre Dame, I was told this. As a Christian, what you deserve as a Christian is crucifixion. And you complain constantly about these little nitty-gritty things that are bugging you. And you have no concept of what the big picture is. When I was in college in Texas, this one brother, I had a concert. We had one year they went to this thing where everybody had a concert. So I had an interview with this one brother, a very bright old history professor, brilliant man.
Mm-hmm.
So I was telling him, I said, I think I'm going through school too. I said, you said, anything you want to talk about? And I said, well, I'm a little concerned. I'm taking too many classes. And I did finish in 3 years. I'm very proud of that. But I'm taking too many classes. I'm afraid my grade point average won't be high enough to get into a good graduate school. And this old brother, he was so funny. He looks at me and he says, Brother Richard, he says, this may be really hard. He says, for you, in this environment, this might seem like a really, really big issue. But he says, he says, here on campus, he says, living on campus in this house, he says, you're getting fed every day, you're warm, you've got a bed. He says, there are people living on the streets. He says, whether you get into a good graduate school or not doesn't make any difference at all. He says, there's a saying that there is no graduate school or no school too poor for a good student, and there is no school good enough for a poor student. I always remember that. That was another light that went on.
That is a good light.
And those are good tastes of reality that I had to get when I was growing, when I was going through this period.
Okay, but let's get back to the to the orientation thing. No. That's, I was tempted to throw in another story too, but so you saw these. I'm really kind of at the end of the tape. We're going to have to come way back again, but you did mention, you know, going to Harper's Ferry and talking to these people and trying to give them some sort of, do you think that they
became sobered by anything that you said?
I had no idea.
Okay, so you weren't able to judge their reaction. Well, what did the woman...
The girl.
Yeah, what did she really... What was her concern?
Her concern was, what would it be... You know, she realized that in the room there were primarily men.
Yeah.
Young men.
Right.
I should say, call her a girl and I call them men.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Boys. The boys and the girls.
Yeah.
And I can say that now that I'm 50. Her concern was, what would it be like being a girl, a young lady there? And I told her that she would be a minority, but a very popular minority. And I think that you may find it in your interviews, that women there got a lot of attention. And I think that was on her mind. I said, yeah, you're going to get a lot of attention, be aware of it, and you're going to have to deal with that.
Uh-huh.
And it may go to your head, but you're going to have to deal with it.
Uh-huh. Did you advise her about how she should cope with anything?
No.
Sexuality?
I don't think so. No.
Okay.
No. Just the awareness that what she was suspecting would be. And there were women there that knew that when they came.
Yeah.
And came for that very reason.
Oh, came for the reason. Okay.
There was a young lady that was in my class was there. She was very open about it. And I won't go into details, because if I gave you any specific
details...
No, it would not go. If it was published, she would be identified. So
that's almost like a hard copy thing.
But for you and I, there was a reality that this was... She knew what she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
She knew why she was there.
Yeah.
And she was not looking for another volunteer, though. She was basically looking for somebody out of AID.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes some amount of sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know. From, you know, and trying not to... Now we're slipping from the... Harper's Ferry in 71, mm-hmm. 72, back to your volunteer experience, looking at women, because there would have been a fairly high concentration in terms of numbers of IVS volunteers at Dundalk and Vientiane.
Yes, there were.
So you had a lot of ability to observe.
Mm-hmm.
What about issues of not just gender relations, but also gender plus race?
Race was not...
I'm thinking of particularly of an IVS American white volunteer dating a Laotian.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's something I can relate to.
Yeah. Was there any...
Not a great deal.
Okay. And any
deal.
Problems
no.
that might have come from that?
I can tell very quickly. I dated a Laotian for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Very funny story I could tell on this, but we'll save some tape. the relationship, the Lao are a very conservative people.
Yeah.
They would make Catholics look like congregationalists. You basically, when you dated, you took her and you took her friends with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know this already. Probably the same thing in the Philippines.
Yeah, they would be the kasamas, the friends that would go along with you.
I did it.
Technically kind of chaperone-ish.
Two or three times.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was thinking of a female IVS dating a Laotian man, and if that ever happened, and what reactions there might have been either by Laotian society or by the American society to see that going on.
There was a girl, a young lady that was, but she wasn't IVS. She was an American doing some other job there.
Okay. Like perhaps within AID or the official community?
Yeah, I think she was a relative of an AID person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there was a volunteer, there was an English volunteer, Curso, I forget what it meant, but there was British volunteers there too.
Mm-hmm.
We had Japanese and British volunteers.
Yeah.
There was a British volunteer that I knew quite well. Female, that dated a Laotian.
Mm-hmm.
Was quite serious about it.
Yeah.
He was from a good family.
Mm-hmm.
And I visited her parents in England when I was coming back,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to know everything. They were very interested in this young man and her and the relationship. So it was serious enough that they were aware of it.
Yeah.
I did not see, saying this, I have not thought much about it. I don't remember much of this going on.
Yeah.
Well, I was somewhat interested in this. I'll tell you why after I've asked the question, because I spoke to a woman who was IBS Vietnam, actually, so not Laos, who did date a Vietnamese man.
Mm-hmm.
And when she would walk down the street with him, of course, there the American military presence was much greater in an obvious way, although there was a hell of a lot of shit going on in Laos, too. And she got a lot of very bad looks
mm-hmm. sure.
from the GIs
sure.
and comments and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And went to, not so much from the IVS male volunteers. You
mm-hmm.
know, they weren't upset that she was dating a Vietnamese guy. They didn't much care. But from the GIs, yeah, so she kept it very, you know, low-keyed and hidden as much as she could,
mm-hmm.
not being ashamed of the man
mm-hmm.
or the relationship, but realizing that a white woman with
right.
a brown man would set some tempers afly. And I
yeah.
was wondering if there was anything like that occurred in Laos.
Not to my knowledge. I think what you're describing basically is when you have a large male population like that, and you have a female, a white female, let's
yeah,
say.
Scarce,
already
mm-hmm.
scarce. It's a
mm-hmm.
it's a commodity, if we can put it in those kind of terms.
Yeah.
And that's more of the reaction than anything else, is that
mm-hmm.
why this person versus me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what's going on in people's heads.
Yeah.
And it's something that it's there, it's going to be there, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
In that particular time period, it certainly was there.
Yeah, well,
and I don't know if it's so much a racial thing as I would say I would put it basically in a jealousy kind of issue and in
jealousy and turf and things like that.
In the terrible emotional shape a lot of those people are in that kind of
mm-hmm.
environment,
okay.
GIs particularly.
Yeah, that's why I
mean,
was trying to make the distinction between the male IVS volunteers,
uh-huh.
who really didn't care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
at least openly not.
Yeah.
Whereas the GIs, very openly, you know, I mean, they were also fighting Vietnamese males who could kill them. So, you know, there was that extra edge too.
You had a higher level of you had a different sensitivity in the volunteers, I think, than you would in the military.
Yeah,
and a better understanding of things, and
mm-hmm.
not a great deal of caring or this kind of stuff. I mean, male volunteers had other options.
True.
I mean, they had the same options GIs had.
Probably better.
Yeah, oh, probably better.
Yeah.
And they could socialize a lot easier. I mean, women
mm-hmm.
could travel
mm-hmm.
fairly easily in Laos, but men could travel even easier.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just do a lot of stuff. You just couldn't, a female just could not do. She could not have.
True.
I could, a story, I won't go into all the details, it was a funny story, actually. We had another friend, Joe Brecky. I don't know if you've run into Joe Brecky.
Joe Brecky. The name isn't familiar
okay.
to me.
Joe and I were invited to we had a number of Australians there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were well paid.
Uh-huh.
And they basically took out some of the best students. I mean, these people were there identifying the best Lao. And they would give them full, they would see that they got full year scholarships in Australia. I mean, they really cut
uh-huh.
America short on this, getting the best. But
other aid programs usually do.
I didn't do that at the time, but like, it was very obvious that's what they were there for, and that's why they were paid what they were paid
yeah.
to identify good Lao
mm-hmm.
students that could go on to university educations in Australia.
Right.
But, and we weren't bright enough to.